Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Later on in the show tonight, we'll be talking about the messy collapse of the San Francisco Parks Alliance. The organization shut down earlier this month, and its downfall has left many community groups in dire financial straits and wondering whether they can continue their work. We'll dig into all of the details. Then I'll sit down with Josh Jackson to discuss his new book, The Enduring Wild, A Journey into California's Public Lands. The book recounts the author's galvanizing road trip across California's immense public wilderness, some of which is now under threat due to a congressional proposal to sell up to 3 million acres of public land in the West. But first, it's June, which means it's LGBTQ Pride Month, and our city hosts one of the largest Pride celebrations in the world. The energy, history, and community here make it something truly special. Joining me tonight to talk about how you can take part in this year's festivities is Suzanne Ford, the Executive Director of SF Pride. Suzanne, welcome back to State of the Bay and happy Pride.
Oh, happy Pride. Thank you for having me, Grace.
Let's start with the basics. Give us some details on this year's celebration. And for example, when and where is the parade and what other events should people look out for?
Yeah, on Sunday, Pride Sunday, June 29th, the parade will step off at 10:30 a.m. at the market and the Embarcadero there. And we'll finish up at the Civic Center. We have about 220 contingents. And then we'll have the celebration, the street fair, at the Civic Center for Saturday and Sunday, and that will open at 11 a.m. on Saturday.
Well, this year's theme is Queer Joy is Resistance, and that's certainly a powerful message. What does that mean for you?
Well, it means that we are going to do two things this year on Pride Sunday. Number one, we are going to stand up to the oppression that the LGBTQ community is feeling, especially queer immigrants and the trans community. And we're going to stand up and draw a clear line that here in San Francisco, we don't share those values with people that are looking to limit our rights. So that's the first thing. But the second thing, we want people to have the opportunity. Now, I know not everybody is going to be joyful this year, but we will find joy in being together on Pride Sunday. And we're not going to let the other side take that joy away from us.
Well, as you mentioned, it has been a challenging time for the community. I mean, with the Trump administration's attacks on transgender rights, and a man was recently arrested for even defacing the Pink Triangle on Twin Peaks. You know, you were a part of a panel we hosted back in March about the growing attacks on the community. And I hear what you're saying, that you're going to find joy this Sunday despite all of the heartache. But for people who aren't able to kind of locate that joy, what's your message to them?
We're here for them. We feel your pain every morning. We wake up, and if you're a trans leader, the first thing you do is look at your phone and see what's happened today. So first of all, I want to acknowledge the pain you're in. I'm feeling it too. And if you're feeling powerless, I feel that powerlessness too. But I do know that coming together and taking care of each other is the answer right now for our community. And I think we have hope. We've been here before, and we're not going to stay here. We're going to keep fighting. And eventually, the pendulum will swing back, and we will start marching towards rights for everyone.
In this moment, how important is allyship to you personally and to the community?
It's essential. If we're going to change anything, it's going to take allies being in spaces where LGBTQ and trans people are not in that space. We need you to stick up for us. We need you to speak out when you're in those places and someone says something that's anti-LGBTQ. It's only your voices that can reach those people.
One of those stories that has come to the fore when it comes to San Francisco Pride has been the pullout of some longtime sponsors. And you all have worked so hard to bring new partners on board, often small business community members, individuals. So where do things stand now? And were you able to raise enough money to support the full lineup of events?
Yes, we did raise enough money. You're right. We had to find new partners. SFO was a new partner. Levi's returned after a 2-year absence. Hot Cookie is helping us in the Castro, and Welcome the Castro is also another small business. We've had foundational help, Horizons Foundation, the St. Francis Foundation, and the San Francisco Foundation all have stepped up and helped us. So I think the story is resilience when it comes to what we faced in March. I was I was really scared. I was determined, but scared. And I think it's a great story to say we are definitely going to have the celebration and the parade. We did not cut anything. The real question now is, will enough people show up? Will people buy tickets to our other events? And will they donate at the gates? And if we do have a good weekend around that, then we'll be good. I think the real question is, where will we be on the other side of Pride? And will we have enough funds to resource us getting ready for 2026? Because that will start like on July 12th. I meet with the board to talk about what went right and what went wrong and how are we going to move forward next year. So that work doesn't really stop.
Yeah, so allyship starts with putting your money where your mouth is, right?
And
buying some tickets. Well, let's shout out some new or returning sponsors to give them some love. Is anybody, I mean, you mentioned Hot Cookie, which is a perennial Castro favorite. Anyone else that you want to note?
Well, first of all, Kaiser has always stepped forward since I've been associated with Pride. And they are the sponsor of our main stage. And Kaiser Permanente shares the same values we do, and we've had a great relationship with them. Alaska Airlines continues to lead. They're just been a solid partner. Red Bull, the list goes on and on. IKEA, Salesforce, they really, and then I Levi's, that was really important to me that Levi's came back.
Why is that?
Because the Haas family, Levi's was the first corporation to give same-sex partners benefits. They've just been a leader in the LGBTQ world, and I think it's really important that they are partnering with us.
Well, it makes me want to break out my 501s, which I may do.
That's right. That's right. That's right. I've got denim on right now.
Well, there you go. That's what it's all about. Looking up ahead, you know, you mentioned that Pride 2026 planning begins, you know, in July. Are there any long-term concerns you have about the financial sustainability of Pride, or is it the same slog that you always have?
No, I do have concerns. I think we have to listen to the community. We're going to have more help from the city government. And I know that's a bad time to say that. We're a little different when the city of San Francisco gives us money. It's an investment. It's an economic investment in the infrastructure of an event that brings in hundreds of millions of dollars into the city. So I think we're going to have to keep working on that front. Obviously, we hope the budget conditions improve over the next few years. We are going to have to, I think, really build the structure of individual donations. We've had a great year for individual donations, but there's a lot of work to be done there to build a modern program that could sustain us. So I think there's a lot of work to be done to diversify our revenue streams. And then we've got to continue to tell the story when corporations are making good decisions, when they are supporting the community, we have to tell that story.
This year's celebrity grand marshal is Harper Steele, a longtime writer for Saturday Night Live, one of the stars of this new documentary, Will and Harper, which follows her cross-country trip with Will Ferrell, one of her best friends. What led to her selection as grand marshal?
Yeah, I was at an event at a Warriors game, an Accenture event, and Harper was the speaker, and I was lucky enough to be introduced to her. And as soon as I met her, I think within 5 minutes, I said, listen, I don't know if maybe you're going to New York Pride, but San Francisco Pride would really, really love to have you. And she said, well, I live on the West Coast now. I would be really pleased to come. Aww. And then I was still a little nervous when I reached out to her, but she was so gracious. And I'm just so excited because I love that documentary. Obviously, Harper and I have a lot of similarities. And then I'm excited to see the differences in how we approach the late life transitioning, because I've done the same thing. And in fact, we're going to close out the Human Rights Summit on Thursday at the Commonwealth Club. I'm going to play Sally Jesse Raphael, and I'm going to do the Q&A with Harper on stage, and I'm really looking forward. That's going to be one of the highlights of the week for me.
Do you have the glasses? Do you have the glasses that you need for this, Suzanne?
I do, I think. I just don't have that blonde short hair, and I really don't have that lipstick color, but I might try.
I think there are people in the community who can help you with this.
That's true. That is a strong suit of our community.
So the parade is the centerpiece of Pride, but it is a month-long celebration. And you mentioned this convocation you're going to be having at the Commonwealth Club. What are some other standout events or moments that you want people to know about that they can, you know, join in and participate, celebrate?
We have something almost every day starting on Tuesday. On Tuesday at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, we are going to have the first ever Pride fashion show. It's called The Threads of Pride. Dr. Nas has put this together. Dr. Nas is a member of our board, has a worldwide following, the first out Qatari man. And we can't really wait. It's going to be such a huge production, but you can still get tickets to that on sfpride.org. On Wednesday at 1 p.m. at the Don Club, we will introduce all the Grand Marshals to the press, and there are tickets available for that on the site. Thursday, the Human Rights Summit as a Commonwealth Club. And then on Friday, we are going to there's a Pride program with SF Opera. I'm going to be in an interview on stage before the opera. Friday night, the Valkyries are doing an event at the Chase Center for Pride Night. They have a game. We're going to be recognized there. So I'm going to jump off the stage at the opera change and go to the Chase Center. it's going to be a good costume change. And then, of course, and Saturday, we'll have the Civic Center will be open. And then Sunday, we'll have the parade. We'll have the celebration. Over at the City Hall, we have just a lavish party. Wendy Guevara, a famous Latina trans woman, will be there. The mayor is going to give an award to Marcy Edelman, the Teddy Witherington Award. And you can buy tickets to all those things at sfpride.org. And then Sunday, you also, if you'd like a better viewing area for the parade, there are grandstand tickets left. And I really need to sell all those tickets, so people please go to sfpride.org and support us, because we don't charge to get in. It is a free event, but all those extra events, we hope that resonates with people. They'll come out, support Pride, and raise some desperately needed funds.
I mean, I really hope you have the best turnout possible. And I want to thank you so much, Suzanne Ford, Executive Director of our SF Pride, for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Grace. I really appreciate you all having me.
Yeah, wishing you the best of luck. You can find a link to this year's Pride schedule on the State of the Bay page at KALW.org. And again, everybody get out there, because allyship is the most important. Happy Pride.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we're delving into the collapse of the San Francisco Parks Alliance. Stay with us.
I'm Miriam Goodman.
And I'm Lynn Winter Gross.
We've been friends for more than 60 years, and we have talked about practically everything.
Our conversation continues in this next phase of our lives on Not Born Yesterday, a show that explores the joys and challenges of aging.
Join us every Monday at 7 p.m. throughout June, July, and August for Not Born Yesterday.
Right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
Hello, I'm Jeff Hayden, host of Your Legal Rights. Wednesday on Your Legal Rights, we're talking about a traffic stop, your civil rights, and traffic court. Best of all, we take your calls and answer your questions. That's Your Legal Rights, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, right here at 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area, or online at kalw.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. San Francisco is a city of neighborhoods, and many of those neighborhoods have small, mostly volunteer groups that care for their local spaces. They do everything from restoring playgrounds to planting gardens and maintaining trails. And now those groups and their work are in jeopardy due to the collapse of an organization many San Franciscans had never heard of before May, and that's the San Francisco Parks Alliance. The Parks Alliance served as a fiscal sponsor and managed millions of dollars in donations to over 80 of those groups. It also helped funnel private donations to city projects and advocate for bond measures to improve parks and open spaces. It was a crucial part of our city infrastructure until it shut down earlier this month amid allegations of fiscal misconduct. Here tonight to help us make sense of what happened and to understand how it will affect our city and the many groups that help keep it vibrant and beautiful, I'm pleased to be joined by Gabe Greshler. He's the politics reporter for the San Francisco Standard, who's been closely following the unraveling of the Parks Alliance. Welcome to State of the Bay, Gabe.
Thank you so much.
And we're also joined by Ildiko Polony. She's the executive director of Sutro Stewards, one of the many groups that relied on the Alliance to manage its finances. Thanks for joining us, Ildiko.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, I want to welcome Tom Radulovich, who's a senior policy fellow for the local nonprofit Livable City and a volunteer with a group that lost its money in the collapse. We're so glad to have you here, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
And before we begin, listeners, we want to hear from you. Have you volunteered with or donated to a neighborhood project? Are you part of a group impacted by the Parks Alliance collapse? Get in touch with us by email at stateofthebay@klw.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or find us on social media. Ildiko, I wanted to start with you because you do work with this group that was affected by it. For listeners who've never heard of the Parks Alliance, what was it and what role did it play for your group?
The San Francisco Parks Alliance was our fiscal sponsor. So they served as a larger nonprofit with 501c3 status that could easily onboard neighborhood projects and provide insurance, a bank account, legal standing, the ability to raise funds and distribute funds and spend funds on local projects. So this is what they did for our organization, Sutro Stewards, the organization that I'm the executive director of.
Mm-hmm. And Gabe, had it been around for a long time? Was it a well-known organization?
Yeah, so my understanding is that it's actually been around. It has its roots in going back to the 1970s, and I think it was only until about 15 years ago that the Parks Alliance morphed with another organization and actually became what is known today as the Parks Alliance.
And for Ildiko, for your group, I mean, it was serving as this fiscal sponsor. Did they also provide any expertise about how to do the work of Sutro Stewards or anything like that?
There were annual convenings that were networking opportunities for partners like us, community partners. The CEO would occasionally make himself available if I had questions. They had a project manager, an area manager, they called it, who was a staff person with the Parks Alliance to sort of help us navigate the grant system with the city of San Francisco, the Community Challenge Grant in particular. I would say that they said that they offered a lot more than was actually delivered. It seemed as though there was intention to offer more than we ended up receiving. And generally, the service was not fabulous.
Interesting. I mean, Tom, you're a volunteer with the Friends of Oak Woodlands. I mean, can you give us a quick snapshot of what your group does and what you are expecting from the Parks Alliance?
Sure. The group has been around for 30 years. So we take care of the Oak Woodlands, which is San Francisco's or at least last remaining old growth forest.
So where is it exactly?
The northeast corner of Golden Gate Park. If you know where the horseshoe courts are, it's around there. Kind of goes over to Arguello and then actually passed all the way to the where the skating goes on. So those oaks have been there since before the park was there. 30 years ago, a group of volunteers wanted to help save those oaks. The oaks are doing fine, but we plant a lot of native plants underneath the oaks, clear weeds, mulch, help build trails, do all of that work. So it was going on for a long time. And then what we looked to the Parks Alliance for was the fiscal sponsor for a grant. So there was a grant program called, and I believe there still will be again, called the Community Challenge Grant Program. But most government agencies do require, you have a 501c3, so a tax-exempt nonprofit fiscal sponsor. And so the Parks Alliance was our fiscal sponsor, helped us with the grant reporting and the grant compliance work that was required to get that grant.
I mean, because the issue here is like some of these groups are, community groups are really quite small, and we're talking about grants in the thousands, not tens of thousands. So to actually create your own nonprofit is just a little bit too onerous. Is that right, Tom?
Oh yeah, having run a nonprofit, it's a lot of work, and for a small group of volunteers who just want to fix up a park, who just want to build a trail, who just want to plant some green things. Yeah, it's no one should have to go through all of that. Mm-hmm. But governments do make it hard to get even small amounts of money. The grants and the grant reporting, but things like liability insurance. You know, we don't have that issue because we work directly with the Natural Areas Program. So we have Rec and Park staff there when we're there. But some agencies, just even to volunteer and pull weeds, you need liability insurance. So there were a lot of things that Parks Alliance was able to do that, if you ask a community group that's just a few volunteers to do, it's going to waste a lot of their time or maybe even get them in trouble.
Yeah.
So it's great. Parks Alliance was doing something very important, just being that mediator between community and their government.
So, Gabe, tell us, how did this thing fall apart? It sounds like such a good idea to have a group like this. And certainly, you know, there were 80 or more groups in the city that relied on them. So how did it fall apart?
Yeah. So it's a long story.
All good ones are.
And I think just a little bit of context is important. And to Tom's point, too, definitely was serving a really important function in this city. And I think another important thing for listeners to know, too, is it was a very, within kind of the nonprofit and philanthropic world, this was a very well-renowned nonprofit. There were a lot of, politicians that sort of were in the orbit of this nonprofit. This organization would throw very ritzy fundraisers to try to attract donor money. And so it really kind of it attracted a lot of, kind of the city's, some of their, elite philanthropists and politicians kind of around its circle. How did it fall apart? Well, we actually should go a little bit back to 2020 when the nonprofit was implicated in a larger corruption scandal that some listeners might know that involved former Public Works Director Mohammed Nuru.
Mr. Clean is what he used to call himself. Yes,
exactly.
I interviewed him once.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. And so, since then, there's always been kind of, at least among journalists, a question of, what else was going on there? Should we look into them a little bit more? And then things really heated up. It was around April when we actually received a tip that the CEO, the former CEO, Drew Becker, had quietly resigned from the nonprofit in February. We were able to confirm that. And things then really fell apart from there as people raised a lot of questions of why did Drew Becker leave? What's going on here? To give credit to the San Francisco Chronicle, too, they've done some really fantastic reporting on this as well. And really kind of a couple things have happened that ultimately led to their downfall. So the first thing is that there was an email that came out where the board chair of the nonprofit, a woman named Louise Mazingo, admitted that the nonprofit had misused $3.8 million. That eventually led to a criminal investigation by the local district attorney. And then, there were a few other stories that we uncovered as well, that the nonprofit was a year late to a financial audit that had been required to fill out because of the Mohammed Nuru scandal. Drew Becker had handed out bonuses to his top management as the finances of the nonprofit were actually crumbling behind the scenes. And then it wasn't until June 3rd or so, that the nonprofit actually officially announced that it was closing. And since then, and I'm happy to talk about this later on too, there's been some interesting details about the nonprofit that we've found out since then.
Well, we have a listener who called in. Her name is Kath, and she wanted to share her story about what is happening. Let's see if we can play that right now.
This is Kath Sakalakis. I'm one of the volunteers in Lakeside Village, and I wanted to let you know a little bit about Parks Alliance. We were required by the city to join Parks Alliance to implement a project that was funded by a city grant in 2020. We created a new community park that we called Lakeside Landing from an underused parking lot on Ocean Avenue on the west side. And I still remember Googling and asking the city project manager, what? This Parks Alliance, because of the Nuru slush fund scandal. Our contract with Parks Alliance was for very basic services. We paid a fee that they charged on our grants and donations, and they gave us non-profit status. They were supposed to keep our donations in a restricted funds and pay our invoices in a timely way. I always kept a spreadsheet for every penny we raised and spent, because the Parks Alliance accounting was so slow and inaccurate. Our quarterly statements arrived months after the end of every quarter. There were mistakes, such as charges that were wrongly assigned to our projects that were nothing to do with us. And things really went off the rails last year in 2024. Payments got so slow that I asked our area manager for a conversation with someone more senior because I was concerned about their cash flow. On December 17th, via Zoom, the chief strategist at Parks Alliance said, no, we have a new finance team, we're outsourcing part of the process, and you'll start to see improvements in 2025. She paid all of our bills the next day, so I thought what she said was true. Even with just a tiny bit of honesty and transparency, we could have shut down all our projects in Lakeside Village. Instead, volunteers continued to implement our grants. By June 2025, our small businesses, interns and volunteers are owed nearly $27,000 in reimbursements. Another $15,000 that we'd budgeted for maintenance and events in 2025 was, and I quote, misspent by Parks Alliance. Their new CEO and the fractional CFO told me that there's nothing left of our $42,000. So in discussing the situation with my 22 and 20-year-old sons, I said it's a bit like getting bank statements that show your paychecks and your rent payments, and then your landlord phones you a few months later and says, why haven't you paid your rent? And then you find out that the bank spent your entire paycheck on their own salaries and bonuses. It's just showed a staggering lack of integrity. In Lakeside Village, we're all volunteers. We had to stop every service and maintenance. For example, a tree that was planted by volunteers a few years ago has died in the commercial corridor, but we no longer have any funding to replace it. For example, the water department contacted me and said, it's urgent, you call your contractor and you repair a community water meter. This is on a public works property. The meter was installed by a grant, but I can't pay a contractor because he's still owed for repairs that were done in January and Parks Alliance hasn't paid his bill. So I asked the water department to turn off the water. And a last example is, we had to stop the litter pickup service that we were doing in the commercial corridor. It was a top priority for small businesses, and we hired Ocean Avenue Association. So the commercial corridor is now back to the same state that it was in July 2023, with litter, tumbleweeds of litter blowing everywhere, and worse, left in the doorways of small businesses because volunteers can't possibly keep up. So we only keep going because we want to see our people get the money they're owed for the work and the projects they've already done. And we want the people at Parks Alliance held accountable for the hardship that they've caused.
Well, so that was a volunteer, Kath Sakalakis, who was talking about Lakeside Village. And I'm guessing that this is very similar to what Sutro Stewards has experienced.
Yeah. So I'd also like to give just a little bit more background on what led to the fallout of SFPA. If you actually look back at their 990 tax statements, you can see starting in 2019 to 2025, a sharp decline in their net assets. So in 2019, they report, I think, $23 million in net assets. The next year, it's something like 19. The next year, it's 13. The net million goes down and down and down until this. The most recent reporting was negative $600,000. So what is seeming like happened is that they started making less money, and rather than make the cuts that they needed to do, they started spending restricted funds on their own operations. And so when Kat talks about, I think she said $47,000, disappearing, the same thing has happened to Sutro Stewards. So we are now out $187,000 of money that we've raised over the past, 20 years of our existence, pinching pennies to be able to do things like pay reimbursable grants upfront, pay the upfront costs for reimbursable grants, and have that security of, 3 months of operating expenses in the bank. Sutro Stewards has seven paid staff. As a fiscally sponsored organization, we're technically employed by our fiscal sponsor. So on June 3rd, we all received layoff paperwork. It meant that we had to shutter our operations. That lasted about 2 weeks while I worked for free with my board to scramble to figure out what to do next. Livable City took us in. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
As our new fiscal sponsor. One thing that I really want to highlight is that Tom was describing really well the service that SFPA, the function that SFPA provides to these small neighborhood groups is really essential. So neighbors being able to get together in their neighborhood and make positive public space change according to their vision, their community vision in their own neighborhood, is something that SFPA allowed to happen through the fiscal sponsorship program. And this is something that I think the city cannot lose. Mm-hmm. So as everybody's pointing fingers and wringing their hands and, you know, asking who done it and wanting, you know, a justified accountability, we absolutely need to hold those who, you know, are responsible for this mess accountable. At the same time, we can't let this vital work of the community fall through the cracks. And I've been dismayed and disappointed in seeing how the fallout happened, because the original reporting that lit this all on fire was April 28th, and that was Michael Barba, SF Chronicle. And then the response from the city and those in power, including the Board of Trustees of San Francisco Parks Alliance, only quickened their decline, mm-hmm. is what I would say, leaving the 88 groups of community partners in the dust.
You know, what's interesting to me, Tom, too, is that it's not like they were providing this service for free. Mm-hmm. They were charging all of you a fee to provide the services that we're talking about. So, I mean, it sounds to me like you didn't. Do you feel like you were getting the service that for which you were being paid, for which you were paying?
Not exactly. Yeah. A lot of the same experience that other folks have had, that, you know, just that question of, how much money do we have in our account? Mm-hmm. And, you know, our account was also individual donations. So I think, you know, when you think about the collapse of Parks Alliance and this betrayal of trust, it's like, yes, there were grants, some government grants. There were also, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars donated by individuals. So people who gave Friends of Oak Woodlands money so we could carry on our work. There's, you know, tens of thousands of volunteer hours that go in every year, just, you know, people picking up trash, pulling weeds, mowing grass, doing all of that, but also providing sometimes, you know, in-kind services, design, technical, all of that service. So it leveraged this huge, you know, outpouring of energy from San Franciscans. So it's a terrible betrayal. So our response from Parks Alliance was slow. They were slow paying invoices, slow telling us how much money we had. But there was no sign, you know, beyond the slowness and the kind of the slow response that there was anything big wrong.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, Gabe, I mean, obviously there's some negligence here, but you mentioned criminal investigations. Is there a criminal investigation that's ongoing?
Yeah. So there's an investigation ongoing by the district attorney, the criminal investigation. And then there's one happening by the city attorney's office because they want to figure out whether city money was misused in this scheme that Ildico was referring to. You know, I think that another just kind of important layer of context here, and this is actually some reporting that just we released last week, was that, you know, while neighborhood groups in the last 6 months or so found that they were not being reimbursed, it really actually was stretching back to February 2024, when the board of this nonprofit and the executives of this nonprofit knew that something was really going wrong with the finances of this organization. We reported last week that the former COO of the nonprofit, a man named Justin Probert, was accused by the board of financial malfeasance.
Wow.
And so which can carry criminal charges, and that means that there was intentional wrongdoing on behalf of this individual, as opposed to what we thought in the last few months was this might just be some mismanagement of funds. People might have, you know, screwed up a little bit, but this really shows that actually there was some intention here.
Mm. Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Nicholas calling in. Nicholas, welcome to State of the Bay.
Oh, hi.
Hi, what's your story?
Okay, Michael. I'm with the Glen Park Greenway. It was a Parks Alliance project. We have about an acre and a half of land in Glen Park. Mostly belongs to Public Works, and we are establishing an oak woodland and a native meadow, that kind of thing. But, you know, the thing that I think is most important, Ildikó mentioned this. It's not so much the finger pointing that I think I really want to see, although it's kind of satisfying to see blame being laid on people. what I'm really interested in is being able to continue operating as a volunteer organization. We have like 100 people, and it's their hands that do the work, 100 volunteers in the neighborhood. And we have a work party every month, and there's other work that goes on here and there. We can't operate without a properly incorporated entity that has insurance.
Mm, mm.
It's just not possible to do it safely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I mean, has the work that your group has engaged in, has it stopped completely, Nicholas?
We were told that the insurance policies were continuing until the end of June.
Oh, okay.
You know, Parks Alliance, everybody says it's collapsed, but actually it staggers on in the sort of zombie form.
Mm.
So it does have insurance policies in place until the end of June, as far as I know.
Mm.
After that, we're going to get a little bit of help for maybe to see us through July from the local community association, the Glen Park Association.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a long-term thing at all. That will maybe get us through July. But the thing is that it's a community endeavor, and we've got a community of volunteers. They're hanging together really well as long as the work's there and as long as we keep sort of getting together every month. But it's going to start evaporating, and
right.
if we have to stop doing it. Now, there are two things. There's really one thing here. Tom mentioned this earlier on. Tom has the oak woodland in Golden Gate Park. He's sort of under the auspices of Rec and Park, and so his volunteers are sort of Rec and Park volunteers. So he's got a standing established entity that can insure him. We are mainly on property of Public Works. Public Works doesn't have the same setup as Rec and Park. They're trying to help us. I have to say that they know what's going on and they're doing their best to kind of organize it. But that's the kind of thing that we need. You know, we need the city to step up and start looking after us so that we can keep on doing what we keep on doing.
Well, Nicholas, thanks for calling and sharing your story, and I hope that you're able to keep taking care of those oaks in Glen Park. I mean, Ildikó, you have found a home and a helpmeet in Tom's organization, and, you know, for other groups, I mean, what is left for them to do?
Yeah, this is what we've been working on. So, almost immediately when the first reporting came out on April 28th, that just sort of confirmed our worst fears that nobody wanted to believe could be possible, people also started organizing, people within the Community Partner Network. So we formed an advisory committee, and we meet weekly, and we've called together the Community Partner Network a few times. And our two main priorities, one is to recoup the funds to make the Community Partner Network whole. This would be ideally all 88 groups. And the number that we're working with is $1.75 million owed collectively to all 88 groups.
Wow.
And the next thing would be to find a home for groups like Nicholas's and Tom's group and my group. So people are dispersing and going to separate fiscal sponsors as we speak, like Sutro Stewards has. And then there's groups who haven't found a new fiscal sponsor that are able to sort of wait it out. Ideally, what would happen is there would be a simultaneous pursuit of recouping the funds through the bankruptcy process, potentially through the insurance process, potentially through legal avenues, lawsuits. These investigations may turn up something that could then result in recouping of funds. I think that will take too long. I think community groups are really precariously placed. There has also been a lot of wonderful outpouring of support from our extended communities, and philanthropists have voiced a desire to help. And this is desperately needed. and also incredibly generous, and shows the city's sort of commitment to our open space. We're known to be one of the cities with the most amazing park systems and natural beauty in the world. A lot of that is because of groups like Sutra Stewards and Glen Park Greenway and Friends of Oak Woodlands, and all the other 88 community partners. And people realize that we did nothing to make this happen, and we shouldn't be punished.
Right.
Which is what's happening.
I mean, it's just disappointing, because in a time when being able to volunteer with other people to make your city beautiful is just something that can kind of enrich your life and your community. And the fact that people are not only just putting money behind it, but their time, and it wasn't really honored, it's tough to hear. Let me just reintroduce the show. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. Tonight, we're discussing the collapse of the San Francisco Parks Alliance. We're joined by Gabe Greshler, politics reporter for the SF Standard. We have Ildiko Polony, she's the executive director of Sutro Stewards, and Tom Radulovich, senior policy fellow with Livable City. It's a nonprofit founded in 2000 to make San Francisco a better place and responsible for innovations in our city like Sunday streets, which is pretty awesome. So, Gabe, you know, what is next? I mean, Alana and her, or Ildiko and her group, are doing a lot to get the community together. There are some of these investigations, which Ildiko points out may be too long and take too long. So what's the next step here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what plays out with these investigations. I mean, I think we kind of already know a little bit that there was some intentional wrongdoing here, but, you know, the criminal investigation is, from according to some folks that I've been talking to, are kind of familiar with it. They're really trying to figure out whether, you know, some of these funds were used to buy a, you know, lake house or, some really, really some kind of deep, you know, serious wrongdoing. So I think it remains to be seen, you know, kind of what happens in that arena. I think that on the other end of things too, you know, what ends up happening to a lot of these neighborhood groups, whether they will be getting their funds back through this, what they call an assignee for the benefit of creditors, which is this bankruptcy process that the board has decided to initiate. I think that, you know, like a lot of these neighborhood groups have been saying, I don't know whether they're going to get their funds back through that mechanism, because just some kind of quick back of the napkin math, the organization, you know, in the final weeks before it collapsed, had something like $1.6 million in assets with $1.2 million in cash. The city came out shortly after and said, we're owed $1.1 million because we were holding money with this nonprofit as well. So that already gobbles up like 90% of the remaining money. So like there's just tons of questions of like, what's going to happen with this bankruptcy process? It definitely remains to be seen. And then, you know, I think one last kind of thing too is the impact that it has on the Parks Department as well, and the general manager, Phil Ginsberg, who, you know, has been a champion for parks and was also a champion of the Parks Alliance as well and attended their fundraisers. And so I think that there's definitely be questions of, you know, what did the city know too? There actually is an audit right now by Supervisor Jackie Fielder to try to understand what the relationship was between this department and this nonprofit, and whether, you know, more should have been done by the city.
Well, that is a big question that still remains. What more should be done? And I'm so pleased that we were able to have this conversation, and I want to thank you all for being here. That was Tom Radulovich. He's the Senior Policy Fellow with Livable City. Thank you for joining us, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
We just heard from Gabe Greshler. He's a politics reporter for the San Francisco Standard. Thanks for being here, Gabe.
Thank you very much.
And Ildiko Polony, she's the executive director of Sutro Stewards, and she is making things happen, clearly. Thanks, Ildiko, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear producer Ann Harper's interview with Josh Jackson. He's the author of a new book, The Enduring Wild, A Journey into California's Public Lands. We'll be right back.
Carol Moseley Braun had served for years in public office by the time she was elected to the U.S. Senate, so she felt she'd earned it. even if other people didn't.
They just weren't accustomed to seeing somebody look like me in those environments. And it's like, I had worked hard to get there.
Carol Moseley Braun on her new memoir, Trailblazer, plus the latest on the war between Israel and Iran on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. Encampment closures in Oakland have increased by more than 600% in the last year.
And I done been through a lot of these sweeps. It's fatigue, you know? You gotta be in a certain zone to survive out here, you know? And sometimes it may cause for you to like put a blockage on like the rest of your life.
Ground level views of encampment closures. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. As the Senate debates H.R. 1, the massive budget reconciliation bill being called the One Big Beautiful Bill by President Trump, one provision could have enormous consequences for the American West, a plan to sell off up to 3.3 million acres of federal public land, much of it managed by the Bureau of Land Management, lands that many Americans have never heard of, let alone visited. Our guest today has spent years exploring exactly those places. Josh Jackson is the author of The Enduring Wild, A Journey into California's Public Lands. His book is part travel memoir, part cultural history, and part call to action. In it, he ventures deep into the backcountry of BLM lands, lands without trail markers, visitor centers, or even signs sometimes. But he finds stories worth telling and places worth protecting. Josh, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Let's start with your book. You focus on a part of California that many of us have overlooked, the lands that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM lands. Can you tell us what made you want to explore those lands enough to write a book about them?
You know, I was an avid outdoor enthusiast, spending years and years in California with my family, going to national parks and state parks. I felt like I had a pretty good lay of the land until a friend had told me about these BLM lands back in 2015, and it really began an obsession to figure out where these lands were and what kind of landscapes they contained. And so I loaded up my kids for a first trip over 10 years ago. We spent some time at the Trona Pinnacles, and that really started the journey. I guess I was interested in BLM lands at first just because I was looking for new places to explore. You know, I felt like I'd covered so much of California, and suddenly 15 million acres just in California felt like they had opened up to me. And so I began reading and researching everything I could on where these landscapes were and what was allowed on them in terms of recreation and what makes them unique and special, and also the threats that they face, including these threats that we're dealing with today.
Well, you describe them beautifully in your book, and your photographs are stunning, and I especially appreciated the guide that you have in the back of your book to exploring these lands.
Yeah, we have over 60 BLM campgrounds in California that are all first come, first serve, and no reservations. They are usually either free to about $10 a night, so they're really affordable. There's usually a lot of infrastructure in terms of toilets, shade structures, fire pits. It all depends on the campground. Hundreds and hundreds of miles of hiking trails. These are places where you can hunt and fish and disperse camp. If you're self-contained in a van or a car and you have the right gear, I mean, you can almost camp anywhere on these 15 million acres of land.
So the version of H.R. 1 that's now being debated in the Senate includes a plan to sell off millions of acres of public land, primarily from BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, and Forest Service holdings. Supporters are saying it's a way to raise revenue and to address the housing crisis. What's your reaction to that?
Senator Mike Lee of Utah is the one who installed his amendment into this bill, requiring the Interior Secretary to sell off between 2 million and 3.2 million acres of BLM land and forest land in all of the western states in Alaska, with a notable exception, Montana. And there's some backroom deals because Ryan Zinke, a congressman in Montana, has called this his line in the sand.
So as I understand it, Congressman Zinke from Montana had this provision pulled from the House version. And so when it moved into the Senate, it was reintroduced by Senator Mike Lee from Utah. And then Montana was exempted from the bill. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. There's some backroom deals, I'm sure. I think what's alarming, though, is the pool of land that these 2 to 3 million acres could be pulled from is from 120 million to 258 million acres of public land. So not all of that will be sold, but those 2 to 3.2 million acres that are mandated to be sold off are from this giant pool of Western public land that belongs to all of us. And, you know, these land sales are basically pre-approved. There's no talk about ecological value, cultural significance to indigenous tribes. There's no option for public opinion, which, you know, if you look at recent polling, like the Trust for Public Land just released a poll, 71% of people across the political aisle were against the selling off of public lands. If you go back to the Colorado College State of the West poll earlier this year, I mean, those numbers are even higher. You know, these are people like in Utah, Wyoming, red-leaning states that are saying unanimously almost, we do not want to sell off our public land. And it's all couched in this language of trying to find places for affordable housing, but there's actually no regulations that actually force these lands that are being sold off to turn into affordable housing.
So if this bill passes in the current form in the Senate and then it goes back to the House, what will be the process there? Because this provision wasn't included in the House bill. Will there be some sort of reconciliation process?
Yes. So luckily, because this is a brand new part of this bill, it's going to have to get flipped back to the House, where they're going to have a really hard time getting it through. You know, it barely got through in the first time. I think it was 215 to 214 before it got to the Senate. But I mean, we can all do something about it. Call your members of Congress, email them, show up, protest, tell them this isn't acceptable. You know, not 1 acre of this public land that we all own together should be sold.
And for people who hear this and think, well, I've never visited BLM land, why should I care about this? What would you say?
Well, you might not have been to BLM land, but I can guarantee that most of your listeners who love nature have been to national forest lands. These are lands that are surrounding our national parks. These are lands you drive through to get to Yosemite and to get to Joshua Tree and Death Valley and Redwood National Park and Sequoia and Kings Canyon. And I mean, these are places where there's rivers where people fish, there's landscapes where people hunt. For me personally, you know, I have a really deep connection with BLM land. I've spent the last 5 years traveling these landscapes, and some of the landscapes that I actually write about in the book and the photograph, these are landscapes that are on the chopping block. The Cache Creek Natural Area, which is just east of Berryessa Snow Mountain National Monument, an incredibly diverse landscape. These are one of the only places in California where native tule elk roam the hills. They live in the Cache Creek Natural Area. There's a big herd there. The Wilderness Society put out a great map, actually, where people can go and you can zoom in on everywhere in California, and it's green highlights the national forest lands that could be sold off, and yellow highlights the BLM. You know, I think about these congressional people. Have they ever been to public land? Have they walked to these woods and fished in these rivers and climbed in these mountains? It's hard to imagine. You know, people think, oh, 3 million acres isn't that much, but 3 million acres is the size of Connecticut.
Thank you so much for your insights and for your book, The Enduring Wild. The book is available now. We'll have a link to it on our website. And if you want to learn more about the BLM lands near you and what's at stake at HR1, we'll link resources at the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. Thank you again, Josh Jackson, for being on State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, 3 million acres. That's something certainly to think about. And that's State of the Bay this week. We're off next week for 4th of July, but we'll hope you'll join us in 2 weeks. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our website page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, email us, stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Ann Harper, who also hosted that segment C. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Dee Miner was our board operator. Stay tuned to hear an episode of KALW's new podcast in residence, Not Born Yesterday. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.